This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Raise your game. Good morning. I'm Tasha Fusil. There's a lot of research happening out there that's meant to help demystify what goes on in our brain so that we can understand our minds a bit better. These quote-unquote discoveries in neuroscience has led way to a whole industry of authors and scientists that are suggesting all kinds of techniques and frameworks to help us become better leaders or entrepreneurs. But Robert Burton, author of A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, says that not all is as it seems. Because despite all the discoveries of modern science, the mind is largely still a mystery. So I get him first to explain the difference between the brain and the mind.
Let me start at the beginning. Let me just give you a little background. And when I first trained in neurology, there was joint training where you had to do psychiatry as well as neurology. At that time, it was thought that the two fields were separate and that in order to be well-trained, you needed both. And at that time, psychiatry was thought that there were sort of psychological issues which created mental problems, and then there were brain problems which created physical problems. The two were separate. Now, obviously, as we've gone along in the last 10 to 20 years, it's become really more obvious that the brain is the source of all of our mental activity, but that doesn't mean it's the same thing as the mind. So let me go back for a second and just say that the brain is maybe 85 to 100 billion neurons. They each have about 10,000 connections. So you have an enormous number of cells in the brain with an enormous number of connections. And each cell does the itty-bitty little thing, a little tiny thing. But they operate in tandem and create what you would call higher and higher level neural functions. For example, if you see an object, there are cells inside your brain that will recognize an edge or a line or a motion. Each of these are separate cluster cells. Collectively, there may be 30 to 40 different clusters that will combine together in sort of a hierarchical. In other words, lowest level would be seeing an edge. The next level up, you'd see an edge and then a line. The level up, you'd see an edge, line, and a color. And collectively, you'll get to a point where you'll see a face. So the highest level of neural functioning within the neurons would be to see a face. And that would be pattern recognition, which generates in your brain the image of the face. Now, that's what the brain does.
Okay.
Now, if you ask the question, what is the mind is at least as much as what the brain does. And then you have an additional element beyond that. For example, if you watch birds flying together, they fly according to what we now call group dynamic or superorganism or collective functioning. For example, you watch birds flying together, you watch whales feeding, the way they all act as a unit. So there are units beyond the individual brain which also affect us in terms of thinking about a mind. For example, if you watch a really frightening group collection, such as, let's say, a soccer game where there are literally hundreds of thousands of people acting in unison, screaming, yelling, or whatever, it's clear that part of what we do is collective, so that's more than the brain, and a part of it which we do is individual, which is in the brain. And when you want to talk about the brain, you have what the brain does, and then when you want to talk about the mind, you have abstract concept of how far you want to extend a mind. For example, if I hear somebody quoting someone else's comment on the radio, you go, oh, he says, the person says, that's my idea. But you know, as an outside listener, no, it wasn't your idea. It was someone else's idea. So I think you have an idea that of the mind based upon your own experience of a mind, which is that it's an individual. We have now a lot of evidence suggests that there's a group component to the mind. How far out that extends is anybody's guess. So the mind is concept. The brain is what generates a portion, but not necessarily all of what the mind might be. Now, that's pretty convoluted, but that's as best I can do.
Okay. So, you know, what's happened now, is it that people are doing research on the brain and then whatever findings, whatever limited findings they have, they're sort of justifying what our minds think and how that translates into what we do? Is that what's happening?
Yes. And what it amounts to, if you think about it, you're inside your own mind, so to speak, as far as experience goes. And a good example would be that if you recognize a face in a crowd, your unconscious or subliminal or portion of your brain function that doesn't reach consciousness will scan the crowd in its entirety and look at faces and decide when it sees a face that it can recognize. And when it does that, it kind of determines what the percentage likelihood that a face that it sees is actually the face it's looking for. So let's say it's looking for John Smith in the crowd, and nobody reaches a certain 50% likelihood, 60% likelihood, then it will not see anybody there. Let's say it gets to 60, 70%, it might say, oh, it looks like it might be John Smith. It'll draw your attention to it. So this is all occurs unconsciously. When you're sitting in a crowd, all of a sudden you turn around and you recognize somebody, it's already been done for you. Mm. That's really two separate functions. One is that the brain computes the likelihood that it's this particular individual, and then it gives you both the pattern recognition and then a message as the likelihood that it's correct. All of this occurs subconsciously, yet from your perspective, you look out there and actively recognize that person's face. So it feels like it's conscious. It feels like you looked out there, made the determination that it was John Smith, when in reality all of this occurred unconsciously. Unfortunately, because that's the way we experience our lives, we're at the mercy how our unconscious brain tells us what it's doing, and therefore all the illusions and deceptions that the unconscious can give us, we are sort of inside the system and can't really recognize them for what they are. So we might feel that we actively recognize something when, in fact, we didn't do anything at all at a conscious level. And I think, in part, what happened was, if you take a history of the last 100 years, at the time of Sigmund Freud in the early part of the 20th century, it was thought that there was some unconscious processing over which you had conscious control to some degree. And as each passing decade, we realize that there's more and more unconscious brain function and less conscious brain function. Now people debate what the percentages are, but I think most neuroscientists would agree the vast majority of what we do, 95%+, occurs unconsciously, whether it's driving a car or playing the piano while you're looking out the window or whatever you do. Most of it is not done conscious control. Nevertheless, it's this little itty bit of conscious control through which is experiencing a variety of subliminally generated illusions, which is how we think about the mind.
I guess that's what everyone sort of, especially in the realm of personal development, wants to know. They want to know how they can control their mind so that they can become better, more disciplined, be better at making decisions. But I guess what we're saying is you can be mindful to a certain degree, but only, you know, in a very limited way.
That's right. And actually, for example, as you may know, I wrote a book preceding this one called On Being Certain. And the central argument is that you have a feeling of knowing that your brain generates when you have an idea that gives you the likelihood that that idea is correct. And I think everybody has experienced on the mild end of the spectrum gut feelings and hunches and intuitions that they're on the right track. And yet, at the other end, the more profound end, they'll have a sense of an aha. Wow, I understand that. Now, as you probably know, you can't generate an aha. That just happens to you. You're studying along, you're reading something, and all of a sudden, you have the feeling of an aha. You can't consciously generate, wow, I finally understand it. It happens to you. Well, if you have this unconsciously generated sense of a feeling of knowing, that's going to inform all your decision-making. Now, if you can step back and say, I feel like I know that, and I think it's correct, and you become stubborn in your opinion or resistant to other ideas as a result, then, in fact, unconscious does carry the day. But if, on the other hand, you say, I've got this feeling of knowing, but I know that this is generated by my brain at a subliminal level, I need to ask myself whether or not I can prove that this question is correct. So if you think about it and you say, okay, what kind of questions am I asking? If I ask, what's the speed of light? Something you can measure, something that's completely objective, then you can measure it with the appropriate tools. But if you ask yourself, well, it's probably objective, but but there may be some difference of opinion on how you gather the data, like what's the best kind of nutrition, or whether or not you raise or lower your cholesterol level, et cetera, is good for you, or whether or not there's global warming. Then you say, okay, I'm now in the realm of data, but the data itself might be influenced by my own decision-making. Then if you get beyond that, like whether it's a moral issue, whether the company is correct in doing something, let's say, that might affect the environment, but that gives a better bottom line for the company, then again, you have to recognize that you're now moved out of the realm of objective data and into the realm of opinion. And when you're in the realm of opinion, you have to recognize that the feeling of knowing that you're correct cannot be tested, and therefore it's purely an act of faith. I mean, faith in the sense that you believe something to be so, but can't prove it to be so. So to me, in making decisions, it's the crucial thing is knowing how you know that you're right. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have scientific method for those things that can be measured scientifically. But that only extends to a small percentage of daily thought. I mean, most thoughts like, should I put the business on this corner or that corner? Should I have red or green awnings? Those are the kind of things they try to submit to present-day neuroscience studies by studying people in fMRI scanners. But those aren't really decisions that lend themselves to objective analysis. And they're the kind of things for which all these popular science books are trying to extend the realm of decision-making beyond what is objective. So for me, just understanding that these are objective determinations at least puts the brakes on long enough to say, okay, maybe there are alternative points of view. That's a long-winded of saying that you can only trust your opinion to the extent that it's scientifically testable, and even science itself has a lot of variability in what data you choose, you know, which facts you choose, what statistics you use to analyze it, etc. So that's my short-winded answer.
Okay. We'll look at how we can sift through all the information that's out there about neuroscience and what it can do to help us with our personal growth. I'll be back with Robert Burton in just a moment. This is Raise Your Game on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're still here on Raise Your Game. I'm Tasha Fusil, and Robert Burton is with us to talk about his book, A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind, which looks at what neuroscience can and cannot tell us about ourselves. Recent discoveries about our brains show that about 95% of our functioning is happening on an unconscious level, and that a lot of what happens in the brain is still a mystery. And so that poses the question of how much power we actually have to change and improve ourselves for the better.
Do you think that we'll ever be able to gain some true insight into the way the brain works? I mean, right now, it sounds like, there's a lot of helpful advice that are written by all these science journalists and authors about how we can learn to manage our minds a bit better by way of neuroscience or scientific research. But will there ever be a point where we can gain some proper insight into the way it works?
I think there's different ways of thinking about this. I have a lot of association with people who do believe that down the road this will be obtainable. I personally am not of that belief, but I recognize that we're both using our own gut feelings to try and give you an answer. We don't have the data for this. In other words, I 30 years ago, I couldn't have imagined the neuroscience they're doing now. I couldn't have imagined the advances of technology in during my lifetime. I certainly can't imagine what will happen going down the road. And without knowing that, it's impossible for me to say. So if I wanted to be intellectually honest, I'd say, I have no idea. On the other hand, I suspect that it's enormously complicated. And certainly during my lifetime and perhaps the next 100 years, it's unlikely that we're going to see a complete unraveling of all the behavior and how it's elicited by the brain.
Okay. All right. So what advice would you have for people who are looking at other people and the way that they do things and they sort of seem to have it all together and then they're reading all these books and they want to know, how can I be a better employee, a better business owner? What advice would you have for these guys if they're looking to neuroscience to help find the answers?
So let's go back to the example of recognizing a face.
Okay.
And imagine that your brain operates with two separate functions. One is purely calculation, like a computer, in which, let's say, it's determining the likelihood that it's a person's face. And then there's a second aspect of brain function, which is it's going to tell you the likelihood that something is correct or feels right or seems correct, etc. if you just think of those two as being independent, they're related, but they're independent brain functions. For example, you cannot know something and at the conscious level and still perform something, and you can feel like you know something and be dead wrong. They're not related. So if you are thinking about how you can make the best decisions, you can ask yourself, how do I get the best possible data? And that would be in the computational sphere, and that would be what a good education is. That's what the broadest general fund of information would be. That's when you draw from as many different realms. For example, this is why you teach liberal arts to people even when they're going to become engineers. And so you get the broadest background for your brain to computate as best it can. But then you recognize that the feeling of rightness is personal, not necessarily correct. And you can hold it out as seeming like it feels like the best, but you try to figure out how to analyze it. And I think that even if you go ahead and they were to understand a lot more about the brain, it's still going to get down to this basic illusion. I feel I'm correct. Is it correct that I should feel correct? If you know that it's generated that in the manner I describe, at least you can look for as different alternatives as possible. It's sort of the open mind versus the closed mind concept of decision making. That's probably the takeaway from this.
For me, anyway, the takeaway is that because I do so many interviews with so many authors about how scientific research has really helped us, especially in personal development, right? So it makes you wonder whether these methods actually work, whether it's psychological, whether it's just sort of a practice that you can do, but it really ultimately depends on you, not really on the science.
Well, you know, I just did a book review, which is coming out a few weeks in the New York Times, on a book that is a book that uses neuroscience to explain business. And what's interesting is that the whole predicate of the book is that if you understand the ways in which you can be deceived, you can make better business decisions, which is sort of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in the course of the book, the author repeatedly makes the very error that he says we should avoid. And it's really the problem of how do you recognize when you're making an error?
Right.
My mean by error is that there's an inherent bias that really steers the information in the wrong direction. And that really is the problem of how can you get outside yourself when you have these experiences. And I suppose it's one of the reasons for consensus and group thought and collaboration and when it comes to complex decision-making.
As the layman, as the person who's, you know, who wants to read all these books, that wants to learn more, you don't know what's worth sifting through, what information's worth holding on to, and what information has been spun in a way that makes it sound so logical. It makes it sound like it's got some real potential and really promising ideas, but you don't know at the end of the day whether they're true or not.
And so what it amounts to, I think, is that possibly one of the best educational tools you can have is to think through, not at any one moment, but gradually, all of the most commonly known biases that affect our decision-making, you know, from confirmation and bias and so on, and become familiar with them, I mean, really familiar with them, in the same way that a quarterback would learn, in playing football, would learn all the various possible ways that the other side might attack him, if you follow me. And then when each book comes up, you try as best you can to say, okay, these are the biases that I know affect writing. If I see one pop up, then I suddenly will lose trust in the author.
Mm.
The more you do it, the more it becomes second nature. And I think so. It isn't that you can make correct decisions. It's when you can recognize when they're influenced by subliminal biases. And that's really hard to do. It takes a lot of practice. I mean, in the case of this particular book, in reading it, I realized there was an actual error in a statement. And I said, what does the error do to? And when I saw what the error was, I realized was that there was an obvious bias which was self-evident as soon as you were aware of the kinds of biases that affect our thinking. But if you weren't aware of it, it read perfectly. Do you follow me?
Yes.
And this
is
the trouble with some of these popular science books.
Okay.
They're all written from the point of view of somebody who's trying to make a point.
Yes.
And that's unfortunately the inherent conflict. The better educated you are, including to your own limitations, the more likely this will become second. It's sort of, and I'll leave you with this, it's sort of the same way that a jazz musician learns classical music, scales, all the various techniques, harmonics, so that he's then free to play unimpeded by what he's learned. But until such time as you get there, you are tremendously limited. Mm-hmm. By the same token, if you read these books without a really clear background in cognitive psychology and so on, you're really at the mercy of the author. To be really free and trying to go, you sort of have to do it on your own. And this takes time and effort, and it's the whole, I think, it's my pitch for better education.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Robert. Thank you again.
So it's been enjoyable talking with you.
Yes, it has. Thank you.
Robert Burton, author of A Skeptic's Guide to the Mind. This has been Raise Your Game on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.